Roll for the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Thursday, March 26. And we've got two bills on the agenda today for public hearing. And I'm going to go a little bit out of order by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 689. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 689 directs the Oregon Department of Transportation to provide incentives for voluntary removal of outdoor advertising signs from scenic byways. It directs ODOT to provide relocation credits that allow the owner of removed signs to construct two signs along non-scenic highways. It directs ODOT to establish standards limiting incentive programs to particularly scenic areas of scenic byways. It allows for aggregation of small relocation credits to create one bigger credit. And it increases the maximum penalty for violation from $100 per day to $1,000 per day. You have three amendments that we've distributed, the dash 1, dash 2, dash 3. Dash 1 and dash 2 make changes to the bill. The dash 3 replaces the bill with other provisions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Embridge. And colleagues, this is Representative Reed is not here with us today. He has his committee going. But Representative Reed and I chaired the interim committee on the sign task force. This is the product of that. It's probably the most extensive task force I've ever met on. I can't remember how many times, but it was many, many, many. Senate Bill 689 essentially is the product of that task force, in which, for the most part, we agreed on stuff. There's a lot of issues with this, which is probably why we have those amendments, that people did not agree on, and we could not reach a resolution on, and whether or not this committee on those issues wants to go into that or not, we will see. But the bill as written pretty much are the agreed areas, and then you will hear about where those non-agreed areas are, and have a discussion on that. I think since Representative Reed is not here, the person who staffed our task force is here, and I will ask that Amy Joyce from the Oregon Department of Transportation come forward to go over the bill with us and tell us what we have. And welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. What you have before you in Senate Bill 689 is, as Chair Metzger indicated, the result of the 2007 legislation that created a sign task force. And this is the consensus bill from that task force. To be able to describe what the four items are in the bill, I need to give you a quick thumbnail on sign regulation to give you some background to understand what we're doing here. So the state regulates signs that people put up on private property where they're visible to state highway. Some signs need a permit, others do not. This is based on the 1965 Federal Highway Beautification Act, Lady Bird Johnson, and then Oregon has laws that go beyond what the federal government requires. Oregon, like all the other states, have to live up to the base level of the federal regulations, or we risk losing 10% of certain of our annual highway funds. That's our estimate right now is $25 to $30 million annually if we're not living up to the federal agreement. One unique piece of the Oregon system is what we refer to as a cap and replace permit system. This means that originally in 1975, the legislature said there would be no new outdoor advertising sign permits. If you had one, you could take your sign down and relocate it to a new spot, but you couldn't just get a brand new permit. So that established a cap. When a sign owner loses their lease and takes their sign down, but they don't yet have a new spot to put that sign back up, they can bank that permit to use it later, and we call that a relocation credit. So today, in Oregon, along these regulated state highways, we've got about 1,700 standing sign permits and about 700 of these credits in the bank. In 2006, the Oregon Supreme Court issued an opinion in a longstanding enforcement case that we had, and the court threw out our permit system, which effectively ended that cap. So in 2007, the legislature passed House Bill 2273, which fixed the problems that the court had identified, reinstated the permit system, reinstated a cap, again, at that level, and also created this task force. The task force met for about a year. We issued a final report to this legislative assembly, and the group agreed to four items. And they are an incentive program to encourage voluntary removal of signs from scenic places, the combination or aggregation of small credits to be able to get to usable sizes of permits.
And Mr. Rice, just for the benefit of the rest of the committee, you might could explain that in terms of credits and the size and
sure.
And when you say aggregation, so they'll know what kind of credits are out there.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Metzger. These credits that are in the bank, some of them are quite small, 6 square feet, 10 square feet, and permits are limited in size. So if that's what you have, an 8-square-foot permit, you can't increase it in size. That's the size of your permit. Once you have a much larger sign size on your permit, 250 square feet, at that point, you can expand your permit size to the statutory maximum. So we have several of these credits in the bank that are, for all intents and purposes, useless for creating signs. So aggregation is the idea that you could take several of these very small signs, combine them into a single permit that is of a useful size, cancel those old small ones, reduce the total number of these permits or credits, and actually have one usable sign permit. So that's the idea of aggregation. The third item that we agreed on was an increase in penalties. The current law provides for $100 per day of violation. The proposal in the bill is $1,000 per day of violation or the total gross revenues accrued over the length of the violation. And the fourth item was cleaning up some arcane language that goes back to factual situations that haven't existed since the 60s and 70s, so we just decided to get those off the books. So the incentive program, if I might expand a little bit more on that, Oregon has, like all the other states, a scenic byway system. This was created under the federal law. And the federal law, and therefore the state law for scenic byways, is that you cannot build a new outdoor advertising sign on a scenic byway. But ones that existed on that highway when it was designated a scenic byway, they're grandfathered in and they can stay. So the incentive program is voluntary, and it is designed to encourage owners who have signs, permitted signs, in particularly scenic areas of a scenic byway, to offer them an incentive to voluntarily remove their sign. So that proposal, which I think is section 2 of the original bill, would allow for folks to get two of these relocation credits instead of the normal one if they'll voluntarily agree to take their sign down. So that's the gist of the incentive program. So in summary, I would say that there is something for everything and for everyone in this bill. It would benefit sign companies, would benefit Oregon business, benefits scenic interests, and it benefits the state in having a bit of a bigger hammer to enforce these laws and preserve our federal funding.
Okay. Thank you for the overview. And we may have other questions for Ms. Joyce later. Any immediate questions for Ms. Joyce?
We'll have to ask her later.
You may? Yeah.
I'll just wait later.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. So stand by. Now, what we have a lot of people signing up today, and so what I'm going to do is, as I call you up, I need to limit you for this first hearing to 3 minutes because I want to make sure people have signed up get to be heard. Otherwise, you don't. So, you know, keep in mind on that. And this will not be the only hearing we have on this bill. This is our first hearing, but because of the length of people, I want to make sure the committee gets this general overview as we start drilling down. So I think what I will do is I'm going to do my best to go in order here. Let's see. I'll take a few out of order just so we have some other comments that are balanced rather than continuing on one side or the other. Now I have a third sheet. So let's ask Leland Asher to come forward. Terry Sandblast and Brad Parsons are the first three people I have signed up. And they're not all together, by the way. They're just the way you signed up. So you can do that. Otherwise, I'll go to the next three.
Do you want to use this?
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't want to testify, then I'll go to the next one on the list.
Oh, no.
I was wondering there. Mm-hmm. You've never been shy before, Jerry. Okay. Start with Leland.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, thank you for your opportunity to speak here. As a portion or a member of the Oregon...
And please identify yourself for the record so that people know who we're talking to.
Oregon.
Thank you.
As part of the Oregon State Federation of Garden Clubs, our mission has been always the conservation of the scenic beauty of Oregon. Our preference in the long run would be to remove all billboards which currently cast a blight on our highways. Under the existing laws, we can only attempt to remove billboards, particularly in the scenic Oregon corridors. We would prefer to use the voluntary systems that Amy has talked about, granting relocation credits to encourage sign removal. Unfortunately, as industry has now so many unused credits currently banked, there is little incentive to remove signs. Recent hearings on relocation credits have exposed this serious flaw in your permit system. We believe that the state has effectively lost control over the system. Permits are supposed to be available to be used by Oregon citizens as long as the number of signs is under the total number as capped by the state. The perpetual renewal of these unused relocation credits now limits access by citizens who wish to use them. Large corporations now control these unused assets and now think of them as assets. This is the time to address this problem. Please adopt a use-it-or-lose-it test on relocation credits. Any credit not used within 2 years of issue would revert to the state to be reinstated as a permit. This reestablishes the state control of the system and provides equity to all parties. As Oregon cities, we further ask that you prohibit any approval of any test of new electronic billboards on our highways. Industries say these signs will be expensive, and once erected and operated, will be not be removed unless somebody is willing to reimburse industry for their costs. We remember that the financial industry sold the U.S. government on a new idea, subprime mortgages, an idea we knew made no sense but costs us dearly today. We can turn off electronic media in our homes cheaply, but not on our highways. We ask your help in prohibiting this experiment electronic blight on Oregon highways. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Mr. Asher. Mr. Sandblast.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I was a member of the task force, and I appreciate the time you devoted delving into our world. I'm here today, though, as president of the Oregon Outdoor Advertising Association. And that is comprised of Carlson Signs out of Bend, CBS Outdoor, Eugene, Clear Channel Outdoor, Portland, Lamar Advertising, Eugene, Meadow Outdoor Advertising in the Dalles, and Torrey Outdoor Advertising from Eugene. Three of these companies are long-standing family-operated companies, and three are national companies. The three national companies, however, in fact, have a footprint that dates back in time in Oregon to the era of the 70s and before. For example, Clear Channel's predecessor was, in fact, Foster and Kleiser, which dates back to the early 1900s. CBS Outdoor dates back to 3M National, which was in operation in the state back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. These companies presently acquired their predecessors, and in doing so, understood the regulatory environment that was present through their due diligence when they acquired those companies. The present set of regulations that we have has been in place 35 odd years. The companies have relied upon that regulatory base for development of their businesses. There are other folks in the state that own outdoor advertising signs that are not part of an organized large corporation or family-owned corporation. There are numbers of permits that are on the street and numbers of permits that are owned by individuals that are in the, quote, the bank, that are just average businessmen or individuals. And those folks also are part of the system. The association endorses 689 and endorses the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. We believe that the Dash 1 amendment related to the scenic byways in combination with the ability to aggregate signs is a benefit to the folks who own those credits and those signs. It's a benefit to the state, and it's a benefit to the visual environment of our scenic byways. That would be an encouragement to remove those signs from those scenic byways. We believe that this creates the opportunity, and part of the opportunity that has been present in Oregon was created from the decision by the Supreme Court. After that decision, and prior to the final adoption of HB 2273, there were sufficient opportunities for folks to become involved in the industry. And there were. State has issued 108 or more permits for signs that were developed during that particular period of time. There are some other permits that need to be issued, and there are a number of violations that have been cited, and those hearings processes will continue through the process.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap,
I'll wrap up because
I have so many people, you know.
The association opposes the Dash 3 amendments totally. And we believe that that raises the specter of takings without compensation. We believe it raises the specter of jeopardizing the state's 10% federal funding. I will answer any questions that you may have, and we'll be here to come back if that's what you desire.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Parsons.
Yes, good morning. Chair Metzger and members of the committee, thank you very much for having us this afternoon. I'm Brad Parsons, Division President for Clear Channel Outdoor, residing in Portland, Oregon. I was also on the task force committee and wanted to thank Chair for having that committee and the task force. I think we got a lot of things accomplished out of that. We support the Bill 689 as it stands right now for scenic incentives and aggregation, neither of which have any benefit to our company personally, but we feel for the industry it is a good opportunity and for the state. The added penalties, we agree with that wholeheartedly over the last 18 months. We think there were some things out there that could have been changed had the penalties been higher for those type of builds, and also the just compensation language. We also support Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments and oppose the Dash 3 that has been presented. Lastly, I would just like to state that in 2002, our company came into the state of Oregon to operate and to do business. We did our due diligence, understood the regulatory environment, and rather than trying to change what we believe the state was doing right, we bought into our business. We would ask that as we go through this committee hearing that we realize that we feel that the state is operating the way that they should be operating. And I'm happy to answer any questions now or later as well.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions of this panel at the moment? And by the way, I'm just because of the folks, I'm going to keep them all here. So as we hear from people, you want to bring them back up because you got another question, we'll do that also.
One real quick question,
yeah,
I think, for the association president, Mr. Sandblast. The question on electronic signs is addressed in the Dash 3 amendments. Irrespective of the rest of the Dash 3 amendments, the question about electronic signs, does your association have any position on electronic signage?
The association has not taken a position directly in relationship to this bill. We did not want to bring forth an amendment related to the digital outdoor advertising signs. We believe that there is a possibility and a need for technology, but we need to think it out, and we need to know how that's going to really benefit not only the members of the association, but the public and our advertising clients. Yes, we will be looking at doing an amendment in the future, but we need to really approach that cautiously.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, gentlemen. Stand by. We may have some questions for you later. Let's go to our next three. Is Chris Colvin, John Lehman, and Nanjean Roller. Roland?
Roller.
Roller. Okay. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Colvin. I'm the Vice President and General Manager of Lamar Advertising, and I'm simply here to state or go on the record that we, Lamar Advertising, supports House Bill 689 with Amendments 1 and 2.
Thank you.
Oh, you're really succinct. I like that.
Well, I like that.
I thought that you...
We like the amens when you've already heard the testimony. Thank you very much.
No,
bring this bad guy back anytime.
Yeah. We got some other bills you can testify on.
My name is John Lehman. I represent and work for Meadow Outdoor Advertising. Our company is a family-owned Oregon billboard company. We're based out of the Dalles, Oregon. And we employ 22 employees and support their families here in Oregon. Our company was represented on the signed task force, which helped create Senate Bill 689. We support that bill, and we feel that it's good for the state of Oregon, its people, and for the outdoor advertising industry. During the signed task force, we did, all sides were equally represented on that task force. Issues were brought to the table to be put on that bill. We had some that we wanted that didn't make it. Others, I think everyone on the task force had items that didn't make it to the bill. All of the issues that you'll probably hear today were discussed in the task force at length, and that was in the meetings that occurred over the past year. And as mentioned, consensus came out of those meetings to form Senate Bill 689. We support it, and we ask for your support.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lehman. Welcome.
Nanjing Roller, the Oregon Roadside Council. And the Oregon Roadside Council was founded in 1932 by Mrs. Jessie M. Honeyman. And she had a slogan, Save Oregon Scenery. And the one objective was to keep Oregon prettied up for visitors. The goals and objectives of the Roadside Council are basically those set forth in 1932, to maintain an environmentally oriented organization for individual and group efforts toward preservation and enhancement of Oregon's scenic areas, to promote and support every effort to preserve and increase the natural beauty of highways and roadsides, and to oppose legislation efforts, local, state, and national, which could defeat or impair the objectives of the organization, to work with government agencies and governing bodies to restrict and control sign blight in the state of Oregon, and to cooperate and assist in the work of other like-minded organizations. The Oregon Roadside opposes additional billboards and also the type and location. Oregon needs to establish a moratorium on both the number and type of billboards. There are far too many billboards already along our publicly financed highways and streets, ruining scenic vistas and other whelming locally regulated signage. Billboard control is an environmental issue. Billboards do obstruct scenic views in a state so exceptionally endowed with beauty like Oregon. Oregon Roadside is determined to see that the beautification and scenic side of the issue prevails. Prohibit LEDs and other signs which move, flicker, change copy as it distracts the driver's attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank all of you.
Mr. Chair,
oh, you have a question, Senator
Richard?
Sure.
Is the park Honeyman Park named for Mrs. Honeyman?
Yes,
yes. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A little history there. Thank you. Thank you very much. And again, if we have some questions for you later, we may. Chris Doherty, Mike Hagel, Stephen Berg. Remember the 3 minutes.
No, I don't.
We served on the task force together.
Good afternoon, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. As Senator Metzger stated, I also served on the task force with Senator Metzger.
And your name for the record.
Oh, my name is Chris Doherty. I'm here on behalf of Icon Group, LLC. The Senate Bill 689 does have benefits for several folks in the state of Oregon. However, there are two distinct groups that do not receive benefit and, in fact, have been suppressed under the current relocation credit policy that's existed for the last 30 or so years. And that is that the current relocation credit policy guarantees the right to any owner of a sign, of which there are 1,427 signs, I believe, currently existing in the state. Any owner of that sign is guaranteed the right to relocate a sign if they voluntarily remove their sign. If they go to the landowner and terminate the lease for whatever reason, they are guaranteed a right under the current relocation credit policy of having an opportunity to relocate a sign. The landowner, however, is not guaranteed any right. The landowner who had an involuntary lease cancellation, an involuntary removal of a tenant, had no choice of their own, has no guarantee under this law from the state. They don't know if they'll ever have that revenue or that use replaced on their property because the state does not allow them access to relocate a sign. We're here in support of Amendment-3, and the main reason for that is that it will institute a program wherein the annual renewal of the relocation credit will stop. The state will no longer annually renew those so that they're exclusively held by any one sign company. If a sign company chooses to remove a sign voluntarily, the credit would go into a bank system, and the landowner, another sign company, or that sign company that put it in there, could at some point in the future then relocate that sign back to that same property, to a different property, but it would then provide protection or provide a benefit and a right to actually to every citizen in the state. And that is what we think is really very important. So, the -3 amendments achieve the following items. They prohibit the use of electronic screens, even if the image is stationary. We felt that was an interesting point that needed to be discussed. They allow all holders of relocation credits renewed on January 1st, 2009, to utilize their relocation credits exclusively within the period granted in the current annual renewal term, which will expire December 31st, 2009. They have the rest of this year. After that, they would discontinue the annual renewal policy for relocation credits by statutorily establishing that the Department of Transportation may not annually renew the relocation credits on or after January 1st, 2010. They also established that after January 1st, 2010, any existing relocation credits that are available through the Department of Transportation are available for use by any person on a first-come, first-served basis, subject to all other requirements for obtaining a relocation permit. They define the relocation credit as it should properly be defined, a credit recorded by the Department of Transportation each time an outdoor advertising sign is removed due to a loss of lease for the future relocation of an outdoor advertising sign. Essentially, we're stating, you know, a relocation credit's not a permit. It's an opportunity, and everyone in the state ought to be allowed to get there. If you would take just a minute and turn to me, I'll give you a little bit of history, to page 4 of my testimony.
You've got to wrap up real quick here, Chris.
Okay. We'll run through this real fast, I promise. Page 4 and page 5, I think, are just important things that everyone needs to know. These represent the relocation credits that are currently in the bank, and they represent the decades in which they've went in and how long they've been there. In the 70s, there was 60 credits put in. In the 80s, there were 212. In the 90s, there were 239. And in the 2000s, there's been around 55. These credits have been held for a long time. There's a reason these companies hold these credits for long periods of time.
Okay. Cell phones are not allowed in here. If you can't control your cell phone, please leave. And if you have one, please be sure it's off. We'd appreciate that. Okay, Chris, I'm gonna move on to Mike. I'm just gonna interject though for a second right here. Is that for the committee? What Chris is talking about and what Mr. Sandblast referred to, and why we'll have more discussions about this, is obviously the issue we could not agree on, and that is the issue of credits and, you know, who owns the credit, how they are, you know, utilized in the marketplace or not, made available or not. That is the crux of an issue that we could not reach, which is, and Mr. Doherty is representing one point of view, and you heard briefly from Mr. Sandblast the other, and that's one we'll have to talk about. Obviously, it's not included in 689 because we did not reach an agreement, but it will be this committee to help decide whether you want to wade into that, but just as kind of a background issue. And we'll hear more about this in the rest of this hearing, and I do appreciate all the pie charts and stuff on this, and I would really ask the committee to look at that after this hearing, because that'll get you more up to speed. It's just that we've talked about it for so long that I understand that you folks all haven't, and it's just too long of an issue for this first hearing to go into detail, but you'll get the gist of it. So
may I close with one short statement, Senator?
Very short.
Senator Metzger. The proposed amendments, -3 amendments to 689 would remedy serious antitrust issues that have resulted from the relocation credit bank and likely do not appear to raise compensable taking concerns under either the federal or state constitutions.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you for your service on the group. Mike.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Hagel, and I am a local business owner and seed money financier. I am also a proponent of opening up the credit bank. Currently, I have money invested in outdoor advertising. I would love to invest more funds in this industry. However, unless the credit bank is open, my options for investing are limited. In my opinion, if the bank was open, we would see local smaller companies looking for funding, providing employment, benefiting local economies, and providing more and needed competition in this industry.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Hello, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Steve Berg. My address is 2154 Northeast Broadway Street in Portland, Oregon. I'm appearing here today on behalf of Joe Weston, the owner of Weston Investment Company, LLC, and American Property Management Corp., and Doug Lindholm, Vice President of Commercial Property for American Property Management Corp. Together, Weston Investment and American Property Management Corp. own and manage approximately 4 million square feet of commercial property in the Portland metro area in Salem. On their behalf, I have a few comments today regarding relocation credits in support for the proposed amendment to Senate Bill 689, which is -3. Under the existing program of annually renewing credits, the Department of Transportation guarantees sign owners who voluntarily cancel a lease and remove their sign the right to relocate a new sign sometime in the future, whether it is back on the same piece of property, the neighbor's property, or some other property. The Department of Transportation, however, makes no similar provision for the landowner who has lost its lease income because the sign company chose to cancel the lease and remove the sign. Under the current law, the landowner is not guaranteed any future right to have a sign relocated on its property. The landowner is not guaranteed any right at all. And in many cases, the lease cancellation and sign removal are an involuntary act on the landowner's part. In our case specifically, last year a sign company notified us as they were choosing to cancel their lease and remove their sign from a piece of our property here in Salem. We offered to purchase the sign structure and permit from the sign company in lieu of them removing it, and they refused, stating, "That's not how we do business." And instead, they removed the sign and obtained a relocation credit from the Department of Transportation. To this date, although we are actively seeking to, we have not been able to relocate a sign in its place and have now lost nearly a year's worth of rental income. This is not fair. If the law does not guarantee the landowner a relocation right, why does it then guarantee a sign company a relocation right? The proposed amendment for relocation credits simply removes the practice of guaranteeing any person the right to relocate a sign, replacing it with a first-come, first-served basis if a relocation credit is available at that time. If you adopt the proposed relocation credit amendment, we could finally complete the process of having a sign relocated to our property and resume our lease rental income. I also have a letter that was previously submitted to the sign task force, which explained an issue we were experiencing related to relocation credits last year. To save time, I have provided copies of the letter and will not at this time read it, but I ask that it be included as part of this record and ask that you please take a minute to read and consider it along with the testimony I've given today. This is truly an important issue for all 1,800 or so landowners in Oregon currently hoping to continue to receive rental income from a sign on their property. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. And committee, again, if some of you may have been involved in this issue. It is a fascinating issue, and this is one that I would ask that when you have some time to read some of the material that is submitted today, because it's probably the most interesting thing we've dealt with this year. And that's kind of good to get off backflow devices and stuff and talk about something else. So questions for this group right now. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May have some questions later.
Thank you.
Lynette, is it T.O.D.? Okay. Marsha K. Whitelock and Steve Geiger. Other faces I remember from our many visitors to the task force.
My name is Lynn Keody. I live in St. Helens, Oregon, and I'm a member of the Oregon State Federation of Garden Clubs. And I've been on
sat in on a few Oregon roadside council things, too. As Rick said, I have attended all the task force meetings. I mainly am addressing the LED issue today as one of the amendments proposed under Dash 3. Okay. Scientific research not funded by the outdoor advertising industry is being conducted. In fact, the release of that information is imminent. It is due to be released probably in the next couple of weeks. I recommend that in the meantime, committee members read the Wachtell report available on the Scenic America website. I have a copy here for you. I have one copy. It's 17 pages. I wasn't going to make 25 copies. Okay. A moratorium will allow time for the research to be completed and an in-depth examination in Oregon to be done, as well as public input to be taken. I can tell you from having spoken to many people around the state in the last 2 years that Oregonians do not want LED billboards. They find them garish, distracting, and too bright. How bright? The sun is measured in 6,500 nits. I haven't figured out what a nit is yet. During daytime, a digital sign can be set at over 10,000 nits. That's brighter than the sun. Digital billboards are 10 times brighter than the surrounding area and 3 times brighter than a traditional billboard. That's just a piece of information. From my own personal experience, I was in Utah last fall, saw an on-site sign that well exceeded that, and bright was so bright that it blinded you coming off Interstate 15 and almost caused us to have an accident because we were blinded by the light of a billboard at Players Club. On-premise signs are small compared to a billboard. We do not need LED signs in Oregon. The only people who benefit from these type of signs are the companies that place them there. As an environmentally concerned citizen, members of the garden clubs do not buy the argument that LED bulbs are energy savers and are green. One bulb, yes, may be green, but up to 500,000 on one sign, that's not very green. They are tremendous energy eaters. The carbon footprint of an LED billboard is huge. Oregonians care deeply about the beauty of Oregon. Allowing these signs anywhere only distracts from our scenic environment. Please join other states in calling for a moratorium and ultimately a ban on digital billboards and signs. Be leaders for the future of Oregon. Once they are allowed, we as taxpayers will pay a very steep price in compensation to get them down. Oregon regulates litter on its highway. Digital billboards are nothing more than litter on a stick.
Thank you very much. And you were right on time, by the way.
I didn't say I wanted to speak, but here I am.
Well,
I have been at most of the task force meetings.
And your name?
And I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon. I'm a member of the Oregon Roadside Council, and I'm also the immediate past president of the Oregon State Federation of Garden Clubs.
And your name?
My name is Marcia K. White.
There we go. There we go. Thank you, Marcia.
I am with Senator Haas' district, and I have been in touch with him. I want you to know that we are in support of 689-3.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Chairman Metzger and committee, for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Steve Geiger, and I'm one of the co-directors of the Oregon Wildlife Federation. It's one of Oregon's oldest environmental groups protecting Oregon since 1936. And we're here today in support of Amendment 3. You might be wondering what an environmental group is taking a position on this bill and why we care about relocation credits. Our group is heavily involved in 3 key areas: peace and justice, forest and wildlife defense, and global warming. A significant part of our mission is to educate the public on important issues that affect Oregonians and Oregon lands. We accomplish this in a variety of ways, including community radio, cable access, video production, documentaries, bus excursions to threatened wildlife areas, and most recently with our billboard campaign. A recent peace and justice campaign was entitled the Iraqi Children's Campaign, and it was centered around creating empathy for the innocent children affected by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It featured a photo of a frightened Iraqi girl running from a war-torn area. And it had the text that said, "Because Iraqi Children's Campaign, because every child matters." Our campaign felt this was an apolitical, we took no position on the war. We were simply trying to create empathy for children. And so our plan was to raise the funds necessary to utilize billboards across the Portland metro area and to get the message for empathy for children out to as many Oregonians as we could. And the outpouring of support that we gained from the community for our cause was overwhelming. We raised substantial funds in a short period of time. And then we set out to purchase the billboards for our campaign. Unfortunately, we ran into some unexpected roadblocks with Oregon's biggest outdoor billboard companies. Initially, both Clear Channel and Lamar agreed to give us estimates for our proposals, only to later renege. And so we requested a meeting, and we met with Mr. Parsons, who spoke earlier from Clear Channel, who agreed to talk to us about why they wouldn't let us go forward with our campaign. Only when we got there to meet with them, we were told there would be no comment, and we would need to go to the corporate office to have any more comment about the situation. So at that point, we decided to go forward, and we did find another billboard company who was able to help us. Unfortunately, they didn't have near the number or the prime locations that some of the larger ones did. After we did a little bit of research, we discovered that this wasn't the first time that Clear Channel and Lamar and some of these other larger companies had used their incredible power to filter what messages went out to the public. And it created a situation that made it very difficult for our campaign. And while we certainly respect the right of private enterprise to provide service to who they wish, we feel that our state's limited outdoor advertising should be a privilege accessible to all Oregonians and all points of view, not just those that corporate behemoths like Clear Channel agree with. While we did eventually find a company who would provide us with a billboard, as I said, we were very limited in the number and the prime locations. So we feel strongly that when dealing with large corporate entities that dominates our state's limited outdoor advertising, that this really is an issue of free speech and equal access for all Oregonians, which is one thing I haven't heard yet today. The situation today really has limited who can advertise and what they can talk about, and that's why we're here today and support of Amendment 3. And in closing, I really believe this would create more opportunities for all Oregonians, and I urge you to support Amendment 3. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to go to John Zukin, Joe Keating, and Bernie Conklin. Start with John, or Joe. John, I guess. Sorry, John.
John Zukin?
Yes.
My name's John Zukin. I'm with Meadow Outdoor Advertising out of the Dalles, Oregon. I operate Meadow Outdoor with two brothers and my father. We've been in business about 30 years. And initially got into this business as an investment. Buying everything that came with that, including the existing Oregon laws that were in place. My comments are going to be brief. I've been, like I said, operating for about 30 years in the state with my family. We believe that that we are in support of Senate Bill 689. It will actually protect the further protect Oregon scenic areas. It reduces the total number of sign permits. It will create more effective penalties for illegal billboards that are built that are against the law. It's actually going to increase revenue for the state through larger fines for the violations. And it creates new opportunities for involvement in the outdoor advertising industry. I'm also here for personal reasons. It's for our company, and it's going to benefit my company and myself by creating an opportunity for our business to expand by passing this bill. It also protects our investment. It also enhances ODOT's ability to manage the industry. and gives them the clear parameter to do so, and it protects the right of outdoor advertisers to advertise in appropriate commercial industrial zone locations. Thank you.
Thank you. And just before I go on to Joe, then, just as a clarification, Mr. Zukin, that you talk about benefiting yours, is that because of the line of the smaller permits that you have that you could now then aggregate?
Oh, aggregate. It would.
Is that the primary?
The aggregation would benefit us. That is correct.
Right.
The also the possibility of because we are a small company, the ability to possibly remove a sign in a scenic byway and receive an extra permit to do so helps us to grow.
Okay.
One that we could use, say, over in Klamath Falls or Ontario or something.
Okay.
You have a question, sir?
Yeah, I have a question, Mr. Zukin. Thank you for being here. I appreciate the testimony. You mentioned 30 years ago you and your brothers got into this business as an investment. I've got three brothers, and it sounds like a great business to be in. Based on the recommendations in the bill, wouldn't it be really difficult for me and my brothers to get into this business today based on the regulations that are outlined here and the regulations that were basically that govern the industry today? If my brothers and I wanted to get into this business, we'd basically have to go to the existing folks that hold the credits and try to figure out some way to negotiate with them to sell their credits to my brothers and I. Isn't that the case?
That's a great question. I thought you were going to ask me how we still all could stay in business together after so many years.
I probably different. Maybe for a different hearing, and maybe down the street. In the
prior to purchasing the company, we saw that there was an opportunity. We were out looking for investments in the outdoor advertising and radio business. And we saw that there was a unique opportunity because of the permit system and how strong the law was. It was still in the kind of the heyday of the Lady Bird Johnson Act to have all of the illegal signs removed, only signs in commercial industrial. We thought the fact that Oregon took it even further and made those laws even stronger were going to actually protect our business. And so, in a sense, we were buying the right to do business in a state that was heavily, heavily regulated. We saw that as an incredible investment opportunity. In the last 30 years, we have purchased several existing signs with permits on them, to answer your question, by getting to know the industry. We purchased groups of signs, five at a time, 10 at a time. We've purchased other small companies. Do I believe there's still opportunity for acquisition? Yes, I do. So if you and your brothers wanted to get into the business, you started to research it and see what those opportunities were, I do believe that there's more opportunity to get into the business. There are still permit holders that have not used their permits. There are still sign owners that own just a couple signs. And obviously, we're always trying to...
But Mr. Chair, just to clarify, but I would... if we were to create the Star Brothers, billboard company, we would have to, if we're going to do business in Oregon, go to the existing permit holders and basically buy or purchase their credits from them in order to do business.
Purchase their company.
Or entire
company,
yeah,
should be purchasing their company like any other company has bought and sold. And you would be actually purchasing these relocation assets with them.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Joe Keating. I live in Portland, and I'm a project coordinator for Oregon Wildlife Federation. To add a bit to, or at least the lens that I'm looking at the situation, is that with Oregon Wildlife and comments that Steve had made earlier, Senate Bill 689-3 amendment is something that we really support. We saw this firsthand. The Oregon Wildlife Federation is involved with the grassroots elements of our state. There's a great deal of interest in this particular area in terms of the overall population of the state. The incident that we had with Clear Channel led us into national radio shows. Clear Channel got Rogue of the Week status with the Willamette Week. The overall impression, okay, is that this industry is a monopoly, correctly or incorrectly as defined. But the impression that I have, and I can tell you the majority of the people have in this state, is that's a monopoly. Anything that we can do to demonopolize the situation, to make it available for folks who are entrepreneurs, who would like to get into the business, opens up that process. From our lens that we look at, that's very important in relationship to free speech. If there is a monopoly industry or a tendency to be a monopoly industry, that has the ability to say yes or no in relationship to a value system, whether it be political or not, that monitors and limits our ability to have free speech is wrong, and that should be changed. And there is a great deal of interest in the element of free speech when it comes to billboards. So please take that and factor it into how you approach this, where we're talking about free speech rights here and making sure that there's more fresh air and more ability to protect that with -3 amendment. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Question real quick.
But then I want to go to the next guest.
I'm trying to kind of get an idea of ultimately where you go. 2,500 permits, that's what we're limited to, basically because of the federal law. The only way to really deregulate this industry would be lift the cap. So what you'd get is thousands more signs out there. Otherwise, there's always going to be a limitation with billboards on free speech. And so I'm trying to get...
It's a very good question. The fact is that if you deal with these credits and allow them to expire and allow smaller companies to get involved, you'll have a larger piece of the pie being passed out to the new folks who want to come in. And that just in itself provides an avenue for different opinions in terms of how one manages their company when it comes down to free speech. If you have two or three folks controlling a market and they have a particular political bias in terms of what gets out there and what doesn't, that situation is opened up when there are more players involved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ben. Welcome.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bernie Conklin. I'm with a company called Century Outdoor. It's a small company doing business in the state of Oregon. As a representative for Century Outdoor, I attended these task force meetings, as did many other interests. Aside from the small operators, there were other interests who attended, but obviously didn't have the opportunity to influence the direction of the task force. My comments are directed particularly towards these relocation credits. Those who own the credits and make up the majority of the task force understandably do not want to see these assets diminished or in value or become invalid. There you have the other contingency that wants to be able to conduct business in the state. Until the state Supreme Court ruling in OMD versus the state of Oregon, small companies were pretty much precluded from fair competition in the outdoor advertising industry because they didn't own a relocation credit. The court indicated that ODOT must modify the system, and thus is where we sit as we talk today. Century Outdoor would like to recommend that this committee consider Amendment 3 of SB 689 to comply with this particular direction. Our legal counsel has informed us this will help remedy some of the admonitions that were made at that time. We understand the intense effort by some companies to preserve the credit system. SB 689 ignores the critical element of a process that is equitable to issuing permits. As this bill comes before your committee today, there's still no clear procedure made available for an individual entity who has an outdoor advertising license but no relocation credit to secure a permit from the state to erect a sign. Several small outdoor operators have spent a great amount of money and put forth genuine effort to conduct their business responsibly, but have been impeded from moving forward with this because there are still this lack of clarity as to what the permit directing can do at this time with this legislation. Another matter that is not provided for this draft is the treatment of those billboards erected lawfully between November 2006 and May 30, 2007, in which is purported that ODOT didn't necessarily have the capacity to regulate the signs. Many of these individuals secured permits from the local zoning authority and moved forward with the construction of those at that time. Regarding penalties for violations, we believe you've got to have a practical correlation between the nature of the violation and the economic consequence. Leaving this to the discretion of a permit director can only lead to inequity dependent upon who the permit director is at that time. As a licensed outdoor advertising business owner, Century Outdoor believes property owners are impeded from the fair marketing of their locations because of the restraining capacity of the relocation credits. To those owners of existing or unused relocation credits, the state, I think, has to take another look, and I shared this in a candid conversation before with the fact that these credits really can't be recognized and maybe have as much merit or worth today as maybe Circuit City coupons do, as we talked today as well. They were worth something at a certain time. By operational law, you had a change in that direction, and now we're looking at seeing how do we move these forward without creating damage. This is differs, I'm sure, from many of the permit holders that exist at this time, but there are a few and many flaws and reasons that make this SB 689-3 the most practical way to move forward in regulation. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions for anybody on this group? Thank you. Okay. Pasqua Pazuzzi?
Pazuzzi.
Thank you. And Brad, let's see, where ahead, Brad. Rich Gaston? And Jeff Baltz?
25.
Same problem. I know. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're not waiting. My name is Pasquale Pascuzzi, and I reside in Portland, Oregon. Chairman Metzger and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to address you this afternoon and express my full support to the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 689-3. My family owns property in Portland in the Southwater district. We have a land lease with a sign company, a large sign company, for one of their single-face bulletin structures for almost two decades. It has been our contention for years that they have been paying sub-market rates for our location. Trying to discover what the true market value of the signboard on our property has proved impossible because of the information firewalls set up by these large sign companies. Last fall and winter, I was in negotiations with this company for an extension of our land lease. Letters were sent back and forth from September to December with their monetary offers to release, declining with each of their succeeding letters. A sentence in their best and final offer letter dated November 21st reflects the heavy-handed leverage this company has over property owners, and I quote, "Also, I feel it is necessary to note that should you decide to decline this offer, the sign in its current configuration, sign height, setbacks, etc., is considered non-conforming under the City of Portland Sign Code and therefore could not be rebuilt in the future." Close quote. Now, I'm aware that the state legislature has no jurisdiction over the City of Portland Sign Code, but it can redress the current policy of the Department of Transportation on renewing location credits. The Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 689 should be instituted to permit landowners with well-established billboard locations to negotiate with other independent sign companies who possess the proper relocation credits for installations of new signs, or to permit the landowners to install their own structures if necessary. As the law is written now, the landowner is not guaranteed any future right to have a signboard relocated on his property and thereby the subsequent loss of income forever if a sign company chooses to arbitrarily and capriciously cancel a lease agreement. I respectfully request that you approve the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 689 and end this monopolistic stranglehold these out-of-state corporations have on local property owners. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question for you about it. Let's go, Mr. Gaston.
Thank you.
My name is Rich Gaston. I work with CBS Outdoor, and I live in Eugene, Oregon. My company has been in lawful operation in Oregon for many decades. I have a lease dating back to 1933 in southern Oregon with a landowner whose family still has that property. We take pride in not only providing jobs to our employees and stable income to hundreds of Oregon landowners, but also in the service we provide to Oregon businesses. When you're talking about the outdoor industry, and people have mentioned it's the benefit of the companies, it's actually the benefit of our advertisers. The ability of an insurance agent in Oregon to reach out to an audience, the ability of a local motel to draw business, the ability of nonprofits to be able to get up and have access to the public and spread their message. That's what we provide. As a long-term operator in Oregon, we have adapted our business to the regulatory environment. We believe we have a good working relationship with ODOT and with other state agencies. In fact, our fees pay the cost of ODOT's administration of the sign program. This is in contrast to several out-of-state companies, including the sponsor of Amendment 3, who have continually sought to disrupt, re-engineer, or overturn the system of permitting in Oregon. This has consumed resources from ODOT, Department of Justice, caused public backlash to my industry. We are in support of the bill before you, and we are in support of Amendments 1 and 2. They're very simple, as opposed to Amendment 3, which starts off with a statement saying that we'd have to declare a state of emergency in order to meet the legal needs of what they're trying to attempt to do there. It's a very confusing amendment, and it requires quite a bit of legal expertise to understand what really is going on. If adopted as is, the Bill 689, we would be interested to reduce the number of relocation credits through the process of aggregation. We appreciate that that was included. That was a consensus from the task force. We would also look forward to the incentives provided to remove structures from scenic areas. I'm a fisherman in the state. I drive a lot of rural roads, and I am with you in terms of the sense that there are some areas that are just inappropriate for outdoor advertising. So we would like to see that be part of the bill. The bill before you is the result of a task force which included diverse interests. We had industry members, large and small, in-state and out-of-state. We had ODOT, we had DOJ, advertisers and landowners were invited, and Pete Frost from the Western Environmental Law Center was represented at almost every single meeting. Oregon went through the right process to develop this legislation. We look forward to moving forward once it's passed into law. In terms of competitiveness, I compete with a dozen different entities to get leases in Portland, in Eugene, in Medford. There's always an open competition. I have several colleagues in the room right here with whom I have relationships in a state association where we're colleagues, and then out on the street we're fierce competitors. We give the highest and best offers, and we operate within constraints within our company, within the region, within the economy that Oregon provides. In terms of monopoly and antitrust, these are issues best dealt with by attorneys, not by people without legal background. DOJ has been on this case since the very beginning. They fought and tried to defend Oregon against out-of-state interests who came in and built a lot of illegal locations in Oregon in the interim when there was this free-for-all because the law had been thrown out by court. DOJ was there at the task force. They've taken a look at it, and they've given us their opinion. So if you have any questions in terms of, is this a monopoly? Does CBS Outdoor have any interest in monopolizing or doing anything anti-competitive? Please, refer your questions to the DOJ. I don't want to put words in Phil's mouth, but we are very satisfied with their and agree with their conclusions in terms of monopoly and in terms of the impact if the state were to try to take our permit credits that we've been owned and operated in the state for many, many decades. So we're very happy with the results, and we hope that you would agree and pass the bill as is or consider our minor amendments that have been put forward, number one and two. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gaston. I've gone through the signed up testimony. Now we'll have a little discussion and members, and keep in mind anybody who testified that we want to bring up.
Can I ask the property owner a question really quickly?
Yeah, we can. Mr. Pazuzzi? Don't leave. Mr. Gaston, please stay for a second because I have a question for you. But I just point out, so if people who have testified, you want to have a question of them, now we have we'll bring them back up. I just want to make sure everybody had their initial, bite at the apple. Rich, I have a question for you, and then we'll go to Senator George's question, because you did serve, and as I said to everyone else, thank you for serving on that. I know it was took a lot of time. One thing, because my committee is always very interested in fees, and so I thought I would just out front, because ask you to explain, because that was a consensus item of everyone, of why, in terms of the capacity of ODOT, how that affects your business and why raising the penalties and fees, and how the task force came to that conclusion and why the group is supportive of that.
Around the nation, you have various jurisdictions that act either swiftly, slowly, or not at all to illegal builds. This is not a specific issue in Oregon. This happens actually worldwide. In Oregon, we have a very set and good process. It's overwhelmed right now with the number of illegal locations that were built. In 2007, the legislature acted very quickly to establish order in the system and restore the eliminate the threat of loss of federal transportation funds that was very much in front of us. The other issues that were contentious were kicked off to the task force, including fines. The fines that are being assessed, and in fact, my company built an illegal location. And I've been working for the past year to correct that since I've been hired. And we just got that out of the ground 2 weeks ago. We pulled it out of I-5 in Sutherland. We have a legal location that we're reconstructing, and that's how we're using the steel. It's costing us a fortune. We're doing it because we want to stay in lawful operation in Oregon. So that is the example we're setting with the state. And this is something that my company does nationwide. We are the ones to look at violations and press the locals to say, look, we're operating lawfully. Please, you have laws, enforce them. And in Oregon, it's been a very staid and stable situation for many, many years. In 2005 and 6, with the court case, all hell broke loose. And we have been inundated by out-of-state companies coming in to try to make a quick buck, overbuilding the environment and causing all kinds of disruption and backlash. People have been writing letters to the editor and newspaper articles, what the heck's up with all these billboards, those kinds of things are not in our interest. So from that perspective, we all voted and proposed to increase the fees from $100 a day to $1,000 a day. There are other provisions inside there that are much stiffer than that. And you know, who knows if it'll be challenged. I'm sure someone will find an attorney willing to take a shot at it. But we're very happy to move forward with DOJ and with ODOT to try to institute and maintain a proper regulated environment in Oregon. That's the bottom line as far as what we want.
Thank you for that. Senator George, your question.
Anytime that the government gets involved in creating a false regulatory environment, you get winners and losers, and then you create monopolies. And this is a perfect example of took a number of years, but you're going to get this oligopoly created by this environment. And I think I'm sympathetic to your situation, because what you've got is you own a piece of property where somebody else owns the actual structure, and they have the right to have it there. Where it seems like to me where you're, as a property owner, where you're sort of being victimized here is that the local land use laws have been changed since you acquired the property. And it seems like to me that that's what puts you at the disadvantage. And it seems like it may be appropriate for the committee to study that in negotiations, if a sign company chooses to move, that the landowner, regardless of what jurisdiction they're in, maintains the right as a use right to have a sign location there. And now what that would happen is we, in essence, preempt the local government from changing it while you have a structure, and because of a lease agreement, that you lose that right. Would that fix your problem?
I think that would be perfectly acceptable.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you discussed that at all in your work group, but this seems like a pretty simple fix for these landowners, because what you have then is you don't have a fair negotiations, and I think simply fixing that one little problem would even out that negotiations between the landowners and the companies, and I think probably people might be sympathetic to that.
Yeah, it's a Senator. It's a really difficult issue because and you know the situation that Mr. Pazuzzi's in is has that element that you're talking about. The other problem though that you get into, you know, separating your individual situation, when you talk about the landowner, you know, they reach an agreement, hey, you know, I'm going to come in, put a sign here, I'm going to sign an agreement with you, but you don't own that. I mean, they own it, and you make an agreement, and then they decide to go somewhere else, and they get a relocation credit. You know, if the landowner gets a credit, too, and they get a credit, pretty soon you don't have, if you're not careful, because you could say, well, they want to get it, but they get a relocation credit to move their sign. But if the landowner themselves then also got a credit, I mean, that's kind of where that could be a problem. But
Senator Metzger, I think what I was probably referring to is that if there's a bona fide company out there whether it's a small one or a big one, who also has one of your credits,
right,
that they can use it on my property.
Well, yeah, that would be a different issue in that, and that would be that gets into
just to make it more competitive.
That gets into the legal part that was some of these other people talk about, which is what we did, and we do have Mr. Schrader here, so he's listened to all this. So because I am sympathetic to the hostage part, I mean, of it, because it's kind of like I'm going to give you a dollar and a bag of carrots, and you either take that or, well, forget it. I mean,
well, it's like
put you in a bad situation.
Apparently, you're a farmer, Senator, from what I read.
My family's an agriculture.
You could only sell it to one party. I mean, the whole spirit of competition is thrown out the window, and I don't think you want to see that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I think what I'm trying to get at is that I don't want to give the landowner credit to have a sign, but that the land use law is not then preclude the landowner from then finding a new sign company that has a credit from locating there. In essence, if I'm not misunderstanding your situation, if that sign company moves, the underlying zoning has been changed on you so that you couldn't start up a negotiations with another company. Is that correct?
I think that's my understanding.
Yeah,
of the city of
Portland.
Land use law. His is a little more unique as a Portland. In fact, and the other testimony we had from American Property Management, Mr. Wesson, is another thing that's kind of a Portland issue with that too. But it's the same type of thing. It's a long-standing sign, and you know, there is a fairness issue that we talked about on that, and it is a difficult one. Other questions for these two folks? Okay. First of all, committee, are there other folks that we want to bring up at this moment that have testified that you have some additional questions for? Happy to bring anybody back up. I'm just trying to do a little time management here. Mr. Schrader, Amy, would you come up? And then what I'm going to do here for this meeting, then we'll move on to our next bill for today. And I really, again, encourage members to read this stuff because it's fascinating things. If it was that easy, we would have it all covered, but we don't. The issue that has been brought up outside of 689, partially in the DAS 3, is one recommendation from one of the groups, is this issue, and Senator George, you talked about it, it's not just the competition part of it, it's you get into local jurisdictions like Mr. Pazuzzi, and then you have other issues because of non-conforming uses that, you know, that turn out and limit other things. But this whole idea of how do we, you know, incent the marketplace correctly, but also those who own these relocation credits has become an asset. You know, I at a risk of maybe making the wrong comparison, I kind of think of it as another thing that we hear about all the time is the gill netting issue, right? Where people have gill net permits and they've had them for 100 years, and now it's an asset that somehow unintentionally the state created, and there's a value on that. And if someone else wants to be in it, well, you can't because you've got to go talk to Joe Blow, who has a gill netting permit, and he may never use it, but the asset is that he owns it. Well, and we have this with the billboards, and this is where we struggled over, you know, those who say, you know, we made a business model, we made purchase decisions, we've made investment decisions based on that this is an asset of value, and then you have others who say, but it's limiting the ability in the marketplace, but to do that, then I have to diminish your value and give me access to what you've invested in. I mean, that is kind of the issue, and I think for the committee, Mr. Schrader, I'd start with you, is from the Department of Justice, who was on our task force. This is an issue from the legal standpoint, and if you could just, you know, maybe capsulize a little bit the analysis of the legal issues involved here as the committee considers what they may want to do beyond the base bill of 689, and that is how to handle these 700-some credits and the various people that may want to utilize them.
Yeah. Certainly. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Philip Schrader, the Department of Justice. And a disclaimer at the outset, the Department of Justice doesn't have a policy position with respect to this bill one way or the other. But I did participate as kind of an advisor along the way with the committee as they had their discussions. And I think that to get the general lay of the legal landscape, I think it's important to take just a step backwards, which is the creation of the cap on signs in the first place. I mean, that sets a different kind of model that is out there than kind of a run-of-the-mill permit process where it could be an unlimited number of permits that could be issued and it wouldn't run into any legal impediment. But here you have a cap about the number of signs that are allowable under the Oregon Motorist Information Act. So that sets the dynamic a little bit different than it would in other circumstances. And in some ways, this Legislative Assembly, I think, has established the relocation credits almost the same as a sign permit itself, because there are a limited number, 2,500 is the number of permits that are available under the state statute. Not a matter of federal law, but a matter of state law. And so this Legislative Assembly has chosen to regulate the number of signs in the state by imposing this absolute cap. The relocation credits were authorized and basically codified by the Legislative Assembly in 2007. And that legislature provision says an outdoor advertising sign that has been removed by its owner due to loss of a lease but has not yet been relocated, and then it says, may continue to have a relocation credit subject to all requirements for relocation. Not an unlimited, you have to be able to meet the qualifications and the requirements that are imposed to have a permitted sign in order to use that relocation credit, but the statutory language is may continue to have a relocation credit, and then a relocation credit gets defined as a credit for future relocation of a permitted outdoor advertising sign. So what you essentially have done by statute, I think, is establish this kind of entitlement to a relocation credit for somebody who was a permit sign holder that then lost that permit due to loss of a lease. So essentially, I mean, I think the legal question boils down to whether that constitutes a property interest that would have constitutional protection, and if you eliminate that, whether that then leads to a just compensation claim by the relocation credit holder. I think there are very legitimate arguments that would support that. It's not a foregone conclusion, but there is substantial risk associated with eliminating that by way of a claim, you know, a takings claim by the current relocation credit holder. And I think the Dash 3 amendments do have a substantial risk associated with them that I think you should be apprised of, and that is that they would essentially, if somebody, and one other component of the relocation credit statutory scheme that currently exists, is that there isn't any timeline applicable to when you need to utilize that relocation credit. It doesn't expire by its own terms. There isn't a statutory timeline associated with it. So consequently, it appears that there would be a legitimate argument that that relocation credit is a property interest that you have your own timeline to effectuate. And the Dash 3 amendments would then impose upon that you would have to complete that relocation within a year, and that if you don't, then it would revert to the Department of Transportation and be available for any other person who wished to obtain that and use it to get a permitted sign in place. So I think there are very, very legitimate arguments that would support a constitutional taking argument if you take that course. It's not a foregone conclusion. There would be arguments that you could make, and in fact, I think that Mr. Doherty's attorneys have provided help in terms of his testimony. There would be counter arguments as to why that would not effectuate a taking. But as you go forward in your deliberations, I think you need to be fairly apprised of that there is a very significant constitutional issue at stake, and that of course would then, redound to the fisc of the state if you had to pay those just compensation claims.
Thank you for that analysis. Any questions for Mr. Schrader or Ms. Drist?
I'm fine.
Go ahead. It seems like to me that federal case law on owning a permit, like for instance, I think the case law around mining permits, 1843 mining permits, probably is very telling on this, is that you if you revoke somebody's permit, there's typically, and they have a property right in that permit or a grazing right, a lot of times that those are takings in those situations. And how would you differentiate that? I mean, it seems like to me that we've basically put in statute what in essence ends up becoming a property right.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, that would be the argument as to why it would effectuate a taking. And some of the cases talk about the transferability of the entitlement that you have under what you would claim to be a property right, and here the relocation credits are transferable. Another kind of methodology of the analysis is whether you have a kind of an exclusive right. And here you don't have necessarily an exclusive right, but because of the statutory cap on the number of permits and or relocation credits that are available,
class right,
it's akin to that. It's not absolute that you have exclusive right, but it helps support the idea that it is. You have if you well, not if there are 2,500 permits and relocation credits that are outstanding, then everybody else who doesn't have one of those is excluded.
You'd have to eliminate the cap for it not to be a constitutional taking. So that's the way I'd read it. I'm just trying to look at the law. So.
And so that those are the arguments that are there.
Mr. Kai?
Yeah.
For Amy.
Yeah, please.
Amy, I want to have you give me some insight into Section 11. There is this group of people who have, during the time when the Supreme Court ruled these things, ruled our system as unconstitutional and was thrown out, or illegal and was thrown out, built these signs. Would this increased penalty apply to those people who built signs during that time?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, I believe that the language of Section 11 specifically applies after to violations that would be issued after the effective date of the act.
Okay.
So I expect that there are signs out there that were built during that window period that we still don't know about. So it is possible that, you know, this became effective, and then after that we learned of a sign, issued a violation notice, then that's, I think, a case where that increased penalty could apply. But otherwise, for those folks we've already violated, I think you're operating under the $100 per day violation fee.
So, follow up, Mr. So those people that you have identified who in essence, built during this window, they're in violation, but they're going to be able to maintain the system the way it is, in essence, pay a sublease through fines to the Department of Transportation. Is that correct?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, I think that the civil penalty that exists on the books today is what we've pled in our violations, and that would be what they would be subject to.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Stark.
Yeah, I'd like to pursue that. I've heard a lot in the testimony, illegal signs.
Yeah.
And it's confused me a little bit because it seems to me that those illegal signs that everyone's talking about are, you know, those signs that were constructed during that period of time when apparently there was no law that governed signs. And so if there wasn't a law, folks put them up. I assume they went through the local planning process, got the local permits in order to put the sign up. I have a hard time believing that those are illegal signs. They just took advantage of an opportunity where, you know, the law wasn't enforced, or the law that was on the books was ruled unconstitutional or whatnot. So are we contemplating, you know, in the folks that basically took advantage of that opportunity, that at some point in time, taking those signs down, forcing these landowners to remove those signs? I don't understand how you can basically say, you know, I made a business decision to you know, spend however many tens of thousands of dollars it costs to put one of these signs up, and then you basically retroactively say, well, sorry, that's an illegal sign, or and you're going to have to either pay $100 a day, which to me seems like a pretty steep price of doing business. And ultimately, if you ratchet that up to $1,000 a day, obviously, then that's, I don't know how you would overcome that. I don't know how much these signs make, but even $100 a day seems to be pretty significant. Can you comment on that? I'm looking at actually both of you.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, the Supreme Court decision was very clear that the court had a problem with the requiring of a permit on some signs and not others, and specifically stated that the underlying regulations were still in effect. So what we had was a situation where folks who wanted to build a sign did not need to come to my office to get a permit, but they still had to abide by the regulations. So what we saw were a lot of signs, a lot of billboards got built where they went to their local jurisdiction, got a local permit, they found a spot that met all of the state regs, and they built a billboard. Then the 07 legislation went into effect that said, now if you have an outdoor advertising sign, you have to go and get a permit. So many of these folks have come to my office, filed permit paperwork, and said, I built this sign during the window. Here's my local permit. It meets all the regs. Write me a permit, a brand new permit, which, you know, we haven't done since the 70s, and we've written lots of those permits. Mm-hmm. Folks who built signs in spots that didn't meet code, spaced too close together, built them in a scenic byway, what have you, we consider those to be illegal signs based on advice from Department of Justice, and we're pursuing removal for those. So we have two different groups of signs from that window period.
Okay, that clarifies it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And yeah, Chairman,
that, that was helpful.
Yeah, I just might add one comment, that the rationale of the Oregon Supreme Court in striking down the former Oregon Motorist Information Act was on content-based regulation, not on any of the things that you have in front of you now.
Right, yeah, it was differentiating between on-premise signs and off-premise signs, but it created quite an issue. But I appreciate you clarifying that, because if they did that during the window, even though it would have been illegal except for the court, but they did follow the regs, then they get the permit, you know. But if they just did it and said, "Well, I'm also going to ignore all the other stuff that's still in effect," then they have an issue. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Additional question, and I think Amy is probably the appropriate responder. So we have a certain number of billboards that are capped in the state of Oregon. I've heard 2,500, and I've got written testimony that says 2,200, whatever the number is, it's a cap. You know, Oregon has grown population-wise over the last 30 years. More and more of our urban growth boundary, we're pushing the limits. You know, we've got more industrial area and commercial area today than we did 30 years ago. Does it make sense to periodically look at that billboard cap and say, hey, you know, we have more business, we have more Oregonians, we have, you know, more state highways that have industrial or commercial activity along them. I'm not suggesting that we put billboards out in, you know, the byways and scenic byways and state highways outside of urban areas, but does it make sense kind of in the scheme that, hey, Oregon's different today than it was 30 years ago? Does it make sense to address and look at that cap opportunity? I'm looking at this as a competitive issue. It seems to me that you don't have, there's a huge barrier to entry into this industry. Got into a little bit of a conversation about, you know, my three brothers and I opening up a billboard company. You know, basically we'd have to go beg, borrow, and steal from somebody that has the ability to, one that wants to sell. I mean, so can you talk a little bit about that dynamic?
I can try, Chair Metzger and Senator Starr. I mean, I think that's a core policy issue. I would note that when I said that some of those signs built during the window were legal, and they've come to us now and asked for permits or filed for permits, and we've written them, the cap has effectively increased because those are additional brand-new permits, so the cap did increase during that period. Increasing the cap, would be a core policy issue. I don't know whether there might be takings issues if you're, you know, diluting the value of existing credits. That, you know, that would be a legal issue for folks to debate. But I think that's a core policy issue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
Follow up to Senator Starr's question. What is the federal scenario? How does our cap compare, and how does that interact with the federal requirements? Like, is 2,500, what would be comparable to be able to comply with the law? I mean, could you raise it to 10,000 and that would still comply with the law? What is the law federally?
Senator Metzger, Chair George, the cap is a unique Oregon situation. I think there may be one other state that has a cap or a cap in replace, although there are four states that just prohibit outdoor advertising signs completely. So this was the method in the 70s that the legislature came up with to beyond the core requirements of the federal government, which includes things like, you know, they must be in a commercial or industrial zone. That's the primary thing. There are minimum spacing requirements. There are maximum size requirements. The scenic byway is a piece in the legislation from 1991, federal legislation, that added that no new signs on a scenic byway. But the cap is not at all an element of federal compliance.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you all. This is a very good introduction to this bill. With that, though, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 689, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 620. Mr. Stenberg.
Mr. Chairman, the offense of failing to yield to an emergency vehicle is currently a Class B traffic violation. SB 620 would change it to a Class A traffic violation. The difference is a $360 maximum penalty to a $720 maximum penalty.
Okay. Folks, if you could be a little quiet as you exit, we have other business before the committee. Thank you. General Ingram, Tina Greiner, and Scott Mullen, please. It'll be real quiet here in a moment. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Ingram, proudly representing the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 620. The Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association represents firefighters and EMTs from across the state. We had the opportunity to meet with Senator Betsy Johnson last fall, who is a staunch supporter of the public safety community. And as we were discussing the issues, one of the issues that was identified by the senator, and we agree wholeheartedly and decided to partner with her, is the problem with the failure to yield to emergency vehicles. We discussed with Senator Johnson some of the options. She had suggested possibly, like buses have, adding a little arrow, the lights that indicate that you must yield. Looking at the statute, we determined that anything that we did, any qualifiers that we put on that requirement would only serve to weaken that legislation. So looking at the statute, the only solution that we came up with that was viable was to increase the was to increase from a Class B traffic infraction to a Class A. That would increase the penalty exponentially. In fact, I had printed off for you copies of the statute with how much the current fine is now and or what is now and what it would be, and very thoughtlessly left that on my chair, but you would have liked it. It was very pretty.
But we have it anyway on our excellent staff.
Excellent. Thank you.
Background.
Attached to my testimony is a copy of the Move Over flyer. I wanted to bring that to your attention because this is sort of the heightening of awareness that we want to bring about with this piece of legislation. This is a life and death. This can be a life and death situation where people are not yielding to emergency vehicles, and both Scott Mullen, who is our second vice president, and Tina Greiner, who is our current vice president, can give you some real-life scenarios as to how that plays out. But this is a life and death issue for your constituents. We know of no opposition to the bill at this point, and we would encourage its passage.
Thank you.
Good day, Chair Metzger. My name is Scott Mullen. I'm second vice president with the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. And I'm just here to kind of give some support testimony to the fact of how important this bill is. Just to give you an example, my response area in the job that I do is from Staten, which is milepost 12, all the way to milepost 80 on Highway 22. So you can see that I have a very large response area. Anybody who has traveled that neck of the roads there knows that there's several divided highways and several passing lanes that merge back into two-lane or single-lane traffic. And I would like to emphasize the point that not only do we want to introduce this bill as a move-over, but to consider non-emergence situations as well. Just because we're not going Code 3, which is lights and sirens, does not mean that we are not in an emergent situation. A lot of the times, and it's happened to me, on numerous occasions when I am merging back into traffic, either if I'm driving or if I'm in the back attending to a patient, we've had to take evasive maneuvers. Not only does that compromise the health care of the patient that we have, but it also endangers the crew that is on the ambulance, their safety, because the person in the back is unrestrained. And if you've ever been in the back of an ambulance, you know that any movement is magnified tenfold. So having the general public and have their knowledge and a fine established to move over or let us merge when we're coming into coming from a divided highway or a passing lane would not only increase the safety of the crew, but also could improve health care of the people in the back that we're attending to.
Thank you.
Senator Metzger, Tina Greiner, president of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters. I couldn't have said it any better than Scott. I also work out in his neck of the woods, and I work for Scio Fire Department, which encompasses about 100 square miles of rural roads, none of it divided highway, which makes it even more scary when we're in the back of an ambulance or the back of a rescue rig, or even just trying to direct traffic with people not slowing down, not pulling over, basically not paying attention to what's going on around them. Several times I've seen crew members come perilously close to passing cars, not paying attention to them. Where I'm at, both in Jefferson, where I volunteer, and Scio, where I work as well, typically we have firefighters who are in full dress, meaning their gear, their helmets, their fire gear, flagging, stopping traffic, slowing traffic down. I've seen it way too many times to count that people just don't slow down. They don't move over. Honestly, I don't know how in the 10 years I've been doing this, one of my guys hasn't been hit or seriously injured with it. And I think Scott put a good cap on it. I've also worked in the back of an ambulance for 10 years. And recently, I'll give you an example of December 31st, 2008, this year, taking a patient up to OHSU on a non-emergent transport. I was a cardiac patient, so we had very good possibility of this patient taking a turn for the worse, but it wasn't a situation where we went lights and sirens, because that increases at least tenfold the possibility of us getting into some sort of wreck. But we couldn't get off the freeway to get to our exit. Traffic would not allow my driver to get in to the lane that he needed to get into to exit. It added 20 to 25 minutes to our transport time of getting that patient up the hill to the hospital. And this was a sick patient. And so, you know, not only is it when we've got our lights and sirens on when we're parked on the side of the road or we're trying to get to a scene, but also when we're loaded and we have a patient who needs to get to a higher level of care than what we can provide.
Thank you. That brings up a question, though. I'm a little confused by that. I appreciate the problem. But so you're operating with this non-emergency, could become an emergency, and you're going to the hospital, and you're respectfully, you know, not elevating your position because of that. But you get in a position now where you need to get to the hospital. Is there any reason why you say, okay, they're not letting me in, I'm going to use my sirens and lights to get into that lane? I don't understand. I mean, that's what I would do. I'd say, okay, I got to go code A now because you guys are not being polite. I mean, why couldn't that have happened? Is there a reason why?
It could have, although, as I've said, you know, turning the lights and siren on increases the risk of someone going, oh my gosh, lights and siren, and slamming on the brakes and causing another wreck without us having a justifiable reason. You know, if my patient's heart rate had slowed down significantly or they'd had problems breathing, I mean, and for something to have happened with our vehicle and then we're jeopardized, our patient is jeopardized just because we needed to get over into traffic, it's really hard to justify that to my boss.
Okay. I understand. Sure.
Here's the question for you. The fine is already $320, and I fully recognize the situation. I've seen some crazy stuff on the roads with emergency vehicles. But how is this not being, how would you enforce this? The penalty goes up, but how do you enforce it over and out? Like in the situation you're describing, well, both the examples, you have a situation where you see somebody do something, but it's not like you have a police officer right there. How do you enforce this, and why aren't these people all getting $320 tickets right now? Because that's pretty significant, and how do we increase enforcement, I guess?
I don't know about other departments. I know there's been several times that we've been in fire trucks going to a car wreck, and I've actually had people pass me with my lights and sirens going, and we report it to dispatch. We can get on the radio or have someone in the officer's seat jot down their license plate number and turn it in that way. As firefighters and paramedics, we don't have the capability to enforce it. We have to turn it over to law enforcement.
Senator Metzger, Senator George, I anticipated your question as to why we would want to increase it. If you look at the flyer that I provided for you, just failure to move over, the move over law right now currently provides for a fine in the amount of $355, not for impeding the traffic, but just for failing to move over. And we felt that if someone is, you know, in the sort of situation that Tina just described, where they are passing or they are failing to, you know, get out of the way and definitely impeding, we felt that that was a much more serious infraction than just simply moving to the other lane when they see someone pulled over on the side of the road. And we felt that it did merit an increased fine.
Mm-hmm. Senator Stark.
Thank you.
The example that you talked about driving your patient in December up to OHSU, that's not a situation that is governed by this law. We're not, the driving public is not required to maintain a safe distance or move over or you know, do anything other than drive and obey the laws of the road. My understanding is that this law applies when you have emergency services, police, or emergency vehicles on the side of the road, on the side of the road with lights flashing. At that point, then the driver knows or should know that they need to pull over, provide additional space, slow down, you know, take whatever actions are necessary to provide, you know, emergency services the space to operate. Am I missing something?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I don't want to confuse the move-over law with the requirement to yield. What I was trying to do was mirror what we'd like to see happen is the Department of Transportation to mirror this campaign to yield with the current campaign that exists for the move-over law. Both are current statutory requirements already. What we see, though, is that the requirement to yield right now does not carry the penalty weight that the move-over law does. And we would like to see that elevated. We would like to see public awareness increased with regard to yielding to emergency vehicles. And I apologize if I confused you by putting the move-over brochure in there, but I wanted you to see the sort of campaign that has been launched for the move-over campaign, and that's when they see emergency vehicles, police on the side of the road. This law is a little different in that when they are on the road and sharing the road with the emergency vehicle, they must yield and get out of the way so that they can progress.
So, Mr. Chair,
yeah,
and that is regardless of whether an emergency vehicle has lights flashing or not. Anytime that there's an emergency vehicle on the road.
Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, I did review the statute, and it does not specify whether or not lights and sirens are going. It just says that you must yield to the emergency vehicle.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Okay. Other questions? Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay. That's all we have. Anybody else want to testify on this bill? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 620. Mr. Stembridge, Monday.
Monday, you have two measures. One has to do with building codes. The other has to do with an SJR that I understand being proposed for replacing that measure. I don't know if you want to. That'll be SJR 21, but it won't be on the subject that is shown in its present situation.
Yeah, colleagues, SJR 21 is a hearing we're going to have on Monday. It's a gets a gut and stuff, though, however. Does not deal with that subject matter. What it does deal with is this whole AIG issue is very fascinating. One thing I found was particularly interesting was...
We don't want to talk much about it.
I'm going to talk about it. When I was just reading in the Wall Street about among the issues of the multiple subsidiaries of this very large insurance company, and said up to 40 states have significant systemic risk, and I'm thinking 40, 50 states? I mean, is Oregon... I mean, just how... And so what we're going to do is have a hearing. I've asked the State Treasurer's Office and the Department of Administration Services to give us some analysis of just how intertwined we might be with this company, and as the federal government, you know, is working very hard to try and break up the different components to reduce risk and to see what kind of exposure do we have within our state, different products, and is it extensive or not extensive, and are there any steps being taken to reduce systemic risk? And so I thought that would be an interesting hearing, and
that
just
will be.
Find
I
out.
I saw that report that was part of that on television.
So I don't know, but I'd like to ask the questions and see. So that's what that's about.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I know you closed the hearing on Senate Bill 620.
Yes.
But I just looked at
it. You can reopen if you'd like.
Well, maybe you should.
Why don't we do that for the public record? Let's reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 620.
I just think we might have gotten some bad information. What the statute says is that the person commits a offensive failure to yield, blah, 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 if the emergency vehicle is using a visual or audible signal as a manner described in ORS 820-300 or 820-320.
Yes.
Clearly, these ambulances or fire trucks or police cars have to have lights and sirens going in order to have this yield deal work. So I think that the example that we were given is where they were driving without sirens and lights. You know, the average driver had no idea that that, yeah. that that ambulance was in some sort of an emergency. So
that's a good point, yeah. And that, notice that. All right, close the public hearing on 6:20, and we're adjourned.